If you want to learn more about the topics of today's episode, visit the podcast website at naturesecretservice.com. Thanks for listening. Okay, people, listen up. Here we go. This is Nature's Secret Service, the podcast that puts you in the room with the men and women of wildlife law enforcement. I'm Ed Newcomer, your host, and today we have Savannah Morgan with us, a former game warden with California Department of Fish and Wildlife, who spent many years working in their special operations unit. Super happy to have her here. She's going to talk to us about a great case. Savannah, thanks for being here. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Yeah, glad to be here.
It's so great to have you here. You know, you were a biologist by training, right? By education and training, you're a biologist first.
Yeah, wildlife biologist.
What drew you to becoming a law enforcement wildlife officer?
So when I got my degree, I decided, okay, here I am. I want, you know, looked for a job, and I couldn't find a job. So I ended up getting a job as a customer service rep at a beer place.
The straight out of college, right?
Exactly. Mm. So I was naive, thinking, you know, someone was going to hire me right off the back. And so I'm like, I don't want to do this my whole life. So I went back to college. And when I was in college, I did a research project on northern sea otters. And when I was giving that presentation, a Fish and Wildlife Service guy was there, and he heard the presentation.
U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
No, it was
a state.
So we're now called State Fish and Wildlife Service.
I know it's kind of confusing. California Department of Fish and Wildlife,
yeah. It used to be Fish and Game. Yeah. So I'll say Fish and Game.
Fish and Game, yeah.
So he was there, and he heard my presentation, and he offered me a job. So I said, well, stay in college and pay a bunch of money or get a job. And so I went with... That's how I learned about Fish and Game initially. And that's where I first learned about game wardens. I met my first game warden, and he was really cool and told me all about his job, how he's outside all the time. I thought, okay, this is my kind of job.
Carry a gun, get to arrest people.
Yeah. I mean, heck. So that's kind of how I got on that track.
You know, that's actually not uncommon. Many game wardens I've met who have become state game wardens after being biologists for the same agency have similar stories where they met a game warden in the field and they start talking to him about, and the game warden's job sounds a lot more fun.
Exactly.
So they end up going that route.
And generally game wardens are pretty laid back people.
They love
the outdoors.
They love their jobs.
And I'm like, that sounds good. Not being in an office.
Yeah. And you know what else? They hate lawbreakers.
That's true.
You know, at their core, I always say this, the best game wardens, the best federal agents, federal wildlife agents are cops first. They're like cops at heart, right?
Yeah.
Like they don't like lawbreakers, but, and then they happen to also like the outdoors and wildlife.
Exactly.
And so game warden work, wildlife officers, special agent for fish and wildlife are the perfect like combination of
totally.
It all, right? Brings it all together. When you became a warden, one of the jobs that you had, you were what in California they call an OSPR warden. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so OSPR stands for Oil Spill Prevention and Response. So basically I was a pollution investigator, but mainly petroleum, so large-scale petroleum. And we worked in the Bay Area, so we had a lot of refineries out there. And so not only would we investigate spills, but we'd also train with them and practice like drills in case a major spill would happen, what would we do, and those sort of things. And so that's how, and when I wasn't doing that, I was also actually a regular warden as well. So I did regular patrol and fishing and hunting stuff as well.
Right.
But that was kind of my main thing, was investigating pollution spills.
Right. So. Yeah. You know, that is interesting. The OSPR wardens, they have that kind of, I guess, specialty you'd say maybe, but they're uniformed wardens, drive a marked vehicle just like every other warden, and they'll give you a citation for illegal fishing just as quickly as anybody other warden would, right?
Totally. And it's not like there's a spill happening every
day. It
so when
every
it's
day.
There's no spill, you're out there doing just your general patrol, which is fun too.
And you know, on that note, one of the things that, as you know, that happens a lot with petroleum spills is it ends up impacting migratory birds, which of course the federal government has primary jurisdiction over migratory birds in particular, right? So I got to tell you, when I was an agent for Fish and Wildlife, anytime we had a spill where it was like, oh my gosh, there's going to be migratory birds impacted, I was so relieved when I found out there was an Osprey warden assigned because you guys knew exactly how to like handle it.
Yeah,
right?
Totally.
It made my job very easy at that point because
we were the same way with Coast Guard. We worked a lot with Coast Guard.
I'm sure, yeah.
So on some of the boats that would go down and they would be polluting, you know, whatever fuel that they had on board. We don't know a lot about boats. So I was always grateful to have Coast Guard there. I'm like, okay.
It's that interagency expertise that's so valuable, right?
Exactly.
So then after you were an Osprey warden for a while, you joined the Special Operations Unit for California Department of Fish and Game, or now Fish and Wildlife, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, tell us what SOU. So what is an SOU? Now you go from being a uniformed officer to plain clothes, right?
Exactly. So I was 4 years, I did the uniform thing. Mm. And then a slot opened with the undercover unit, which was SOU, which stands for Special Operations Unit. And so I was thinking, you know, I've only been on for 4 years, but I'm going to give it a shot because, you know, these guys were the secret squirrels, we called it, and I wanted to be part of that. So I applied and I got on, and so I was really stoked. So if you look on paper, what we do is we investigate, infiltrate, and apprehend poachers or people that are out there poaching wildlife for profit. But what we're really doing is we're undercover wardens. Mm-hmm. Like any undercover person, whether it be drugs or anything else, we're in plain clothes. I drove around in a minivan. Mm-hmm. I loved my little minivan. have undercover IDs, bank accounts, social media stuff and everything. So that's what we do.
Yep. Yeah. We, as you know, as U.S. Fish and Wildlife agents, you and I were actually talking about this at lunch. We come out of the academy as plain clothes, you know, federal investigators. Yeah. But in the states that do have SOU types units or, mm-hmm. or detectives, plainclothes state officers, you're the unit we kind of normally automatically liaison with because you're kind of doing exactly what we do as federal agents. You're just doing it on the state side.
Yeah.
So it's a nice, easy way for us to mix.
Exactly.
And I have to tell you, I think, honestly, the OSPR experience was probably really valuable for you prior to going into SOU because the investigations that an OSPR warden does are complex and they can be long-lasting. They can take a long time to solve, right?
Yeah.
And they require sometimes paperwork analysis, subpoenas, search warrants, whatever, in terms of looking at records and histories.
Totally.
And that is exactly what an SOU warden is doing, right?
And working with a lot of other people, too.
Yeah,
because exactly. With the SOU, we had to work with uniform wardens. We work with the feds and all different sort of people. Same thing with OSPR.
Yeah.
So you're actually right. Yeah. I never thought of it that way, but totally.
No, I think OSPR wardens are, you know, they get kind of a crash course in complex investigations pretty early in their careers, if that's what they end up doing. Yeah, kind of neat. You know, now we're going to take a quick break from you because one of the things I always try to do is get my audience to send me questions. And they never do. But I got a question.
Oh, my gosh.
And we'll both be able to answer it, I think. I got a question from a listener named Paula in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And Paula wanted to know how often does a forensics lab play a role in a fish and wildlife case, or does it even play a role? And I'm going to answer for the Fed side, but I want you to answer for the state side. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, we have a national forensics lab for wildlife, and that's all they do is wildlife crime forensic work. And they're totally devoted to doing the support work for U.S. Fish and Wildlife special agents and wildlife inspectors, and they also will do forensic work on behalf of the states at their request. And I used our forensics lab many times for they can do DNA comparison to identify a wildlife part and tell you what animal it came from. They can do ballistics testings, fingerprints. They have a morphology section so you can do species ID based on, you know, comparison of similarity comparisons.
Yep.
I mean, I used it many times for different types of cases, cause of death, all of those things. Does California have a lab?
We do. Yeah, in Sacramento. Actually, a pretty good-sized lab. And I know we're going to eventually talk about deadliest. They're working on determining finding a way to determine, did these dahlias come from the nursery or were they from the wild? And trying to cut, because that's a problem. Everyone's going to say, hey, I got these in a nursery, you know? So how do you prove otherwise? And so they're looking into that. But beyond that, they also can do the sexing thing. So if we get a piece of meat and we're like, this is obviously deer meat, is it a doe? They can say yes or no. And one of the cases I worked on was shark fins. So what kind of shark fin is this? Is it a restricted species? And they can do that too. So they do a lot of stuff.
Yeah. And some labs, you know, around the country specialize in certain things or they're better at certain things. So again, it's, I remember I used your lab when I was doing some sea otter work, even though sea otters were, are federally protected. Your lab had more expertise on sea otters.
That's cool.
So it's always good to know which labs are focusing on what.
Yeah, or what their workload is, because you might be able to sneak your case into one lab where the other one's full for now.
Exactly. So interesting. I'm glad you brought the plant up, the Dudlia, because what I want to talk to you about today is this amazing case you worked on involving plant trafficking. And I don't think sometimes people don't realize that Fish and Wildlife agencies also protect plants and the environment where all of these animals that we normally think about them protecting live, right? And these plants that they rely on. And I'll give you an interesting statistic. It's kind of hard to put firm numbers on things, but the estimate on the amount of money generated by wildlife trafficking every year is generally estimated between $10 and $20 billion a year.
Wow.
Now, you know, internationally on wildlife trafficking. But if you add plants into that, plant trafficking, it's exceeds $100 billion a year. Easy.
I totally believe it.
Because that includes, of course, timber trafficking.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of, you know, hardwoods around the world that are trafficked. And these plants are trafficked pretty frequently, and there's big money in it, and it does unbelievable damage to the environment when you start taking out commercial quantities of plants, right?
Yeah, and you know what? The one thing I also was trying to explain to the district attorney's office, like, they're like, why is this important?
Yeah, prosecutors often don't know why this is important.
Yeah, and I say, well, because of what you're saying, these large numbers, but they also don't have any means of protecting themselves.
Right.
You know, a deer can go and run away. It can do some sort of avoidance when it comes to poachers. What does a plant do? It's stuck there.
Exactly.
You know, so there's no way. So that's kind of scary. And so if these guys can easily just go on a bluff and rip out thousands, And it's that easy. You know, there's no protections for it. So it's kind of scary.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
And along those lines, the plant we're going to talk about today is a Dudlia. Tell us what a Dudlia plant is like, and it's where it lives and its growth pattern and all of that.
So my first case that I got involving Dudlias, I remember bringing in a warrant. It was I was going to put a tracker on a vehicle, on a suspect's vehicle. And I got in front of the judge and it was the same thing, right? So I always try to write a little paragraph that explains what the Dudlia is.
What is it? Why is it important?
Yeah. So I remember him looking at me and he goes, Dudlia. And he called it Dudlia. And you never correct a judge, right? So I'm like, yeah, he's all, what is this? And of course, the part he didn't say is, and why the heck should I care, right? Because a lot of our judges, they're also dealing with homicides and violent crimes. So why do I care about a stupid plant?
Same for the feds, right?
Yeah.
They got a terrorism case right before your wildlife case comes through.
And now you have this cute little plant. Why do I care?
Exactly.
And so first off, I told him, well, okay, it is a plant. It's a succulent. And it looks kind of like a lotus flower, if you know what a lotus flower is.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about lotus flowers is they only bloom for like 3 to 4 days. But a Dudlia, it's actually its leaves that are succulent and form this beautiful flower-looking thing. And they look like that all the time. So it's like always having this lotus flower with you. And the other thing is, in some countries, the lotus flower has a cultural significance,
right?
Especially in Asian countries. So a lot of times you'll see like a Buddha statue or other deities that have the lotus flower underneath them. And it represents compassion, various things like that. So that's one of the things that it makes them so interesting to people. But what's also interesting about Dudlias is, as you know, wildlife that's being poached at a commercial level, you have that which is poached for delicacy because it tastes really good, like caviar.
Right.
And then you have things that are being poached because of medicinal purposes, like gallbladders, abalone, that sort of thing. Deadliest don't fit in either one of those.
Yeah, they're not eaten.
They're simply being poached because they're pretty.
Yeah.
You know, that to me, it was like, wow, okay. You know, so I explained to him what Deadliest were, and their name is Live Forever. So they live for a really long time.
That's what Deadliest means?
Yeah.
Live Forever.
Live Forever.
Oh, that's cool.
So they can live up to, one of the biologists was telling me, he showed me one of the Deadliest plants that had been poached. He said, this can be anywhere from 50 to 100 years old.
Yeah.
He's like, and it takes them a really long time to get that size, which is another problem, right? So it's not like these things are growing really quickly, you know, no problem. They'll rejuvenate. They're not. They're really slow growers.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, so there's these beautiful plants or succulents, and they grow on our coastal bluffs. Hmm. And so why is that important? Well, a lot of the coastal bluff areas are actually homes to a lot of other plants that are really, you know, a sensitive species. Mm-hmm. So if you're out there traipsing around the bluff trying to get these deadliest, you're also stepping on these other plants, these sensitive environments. They're also, so deadliest can be found on flatter areas, but mainly the ones that these people we found were poaching, or the poachers were poaching the plants that were on these bluff side.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they go on these bluffs, they're actually kicking a lot of the soil off.
Right.
And when they do that, you pretty much create an area that's uninhabitable because now it's just all rock. All the soil is gone.
Right.
And so it's really difficult to even put the plant back to those areas.
Interesting. Okay.
And so they've moved to these areas, these bluff areas, as a protection to themselves, you know. So they're in a sensitive environment. And we discovered through these cases that we're going to talk about that people, because they're so easily poached, they're taking them by the thousands and thousands.
So they'll completely denude a whole hillside, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And pretty quickly too, you know. But the other thing is they also have another significance. They're also a food source. Whenever you're talking about plants, right, you have the flower, which is for pollinators, like hummingbirds can utilize the flowers and other pollinators.
Okay.
And they also produce seeds like anything else. And those are eaten by birds and stuff. And the plant can be eaten. So it's also a food source. And as we've learned, you know, when we're talking plants, they're all part of this web. So if you take out one plant, you're now impacting some of these other animals, and other animals eat those animals and so forth, and you're really messing with the whole web.
Right.
So so they do have a significance. Yeah. They are important, and we don't want people coming to our state and taking them by the thousands.
Definitely not, because it does have that weird ripple effect. And so eventually the plant itself could become threatened or endangered.
Yeah.
But then you've got, you know, It protects the soil from erosion. It's a food source. It might be a sheltering source for animals, right?
Yeah.
It just the
bugs.
The importance of plants to the rest of the wildlife world is so critical.
Yeah. So we love the big fuzzy animals.
Yeah,
we love
the
bears
big,
and all these things, but we forget about the plants that they rely on.
Bring me the little tiger case, not the plant case, right?
Yeah,
that's what the prosecutors love.
Yeah, it was the same thing.
Yeah. So, the other thing, these succulents, I've read, they grow sometimes like a millimeter or two a year.
Oh,
maybe 3-4 millimeters a year is all
they grow. I'm actually growing some now for
the
California Native Plants Society.
Oh, okay.
And I've discovered they'll sprout pretty quickly in perfect conditions. This is not in the wild. That's even harder.
Right.
But then I'm sitting there going, come on, you know, it's a really, really slow grower.
Yeah. And that's why, you know, people say, well, why don't they just propagate these in a greenhouse? It takes years and years and years to grow one that would be valuable, right?
Exactly. And if you're a nursery, you can't do that. You can't wait for 15 years to sell your plant, or 50 years to sell some of the ones that they're stealing.
Yeah.
There's no, but we are trying to do that.
Yeah.
There are people like UC Santa Cruz that are trying to get these plants out, their seeds out there so that people will use that instead of poaching the plants. But again, they're
it's
not going
to
50
go
years.
The big one.
Yeah, that's a 50-year plant. Yeah. I'm not going to wait 50 years for it to get there.
If you want the big money.
Exactly.
That's true for like saltwater coral too, even though it's a living, you know, creature.
Yeah.
They do propagate coral for the aquarium trade in, but you know, the propagated ones are maybe, you know, 1/4 inch to 1.5 inches. You go get one from the wild, you get a 5-6 inch piece that's who knows how old that you can sell for $1,000.
Exactly.
Rather than having it in your aquarium for, you know, for 10 years while it grows. And you know, the other thing is Deadliest, like live coral, very difficult. I mean, it's not easy to keep them alive in a captive environment, I guess, right?
Yeah.
A lot of people, like a lot of people with cactuses, they kill them.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
They overwater them or they underwater them. And then you got to go buy another. So there's like this guaranteed market for these things.
Yeah, and some deadly have horizontal roots.
Ah.
So it's not like you just dig your hole, stick them in there.
Right.
The root system's not like that. And once you mess it up, trying to replant them even, our biologists are finding it's not that easy. And so you go and you put them and they all look good when you leave.
Yep.
But then a windstorm comes or something knocks them over and they're really susceptible to being rerooted.
Interesting. You know, shallow roots.
Exactly. So
fascinating. So how does a SOU warden, how does a Dudley poaching case come to the attention of California Department of Fish and Wildlife? And then how does that make its way to an SOU warden?
So it first started out, I have to give credit to the uniform guys.
Well, it's usually the uniform guys that's come across the stuff, right?
And even before that, I have to give credit to the public. Because it all started with this lady. She's in a small town in Mendocino County in a post office.
That's up north, right?
Mendocino exactly.
County for
North Coast.
North Coast.
And she walks into the post office, you know, and she's expecting to say hi to the front counter lady. You know, they all know each other and so forth. And she got behind this person who had just dozens of boxes. And all of them were being shipped to China. Ah. And so they were having to fill out these customs forms for her. So she's a little annoyed. She thought she was just going to pop in and pop out, right? So she has nothing better to do. So she starts listening in to what this guy is saying. And so she also notices the dirt's coming out of the bottom of these boxes. Okay. And so that's weird.
Okay.
And so she hears the post office lady ask, well, hey, you know, what's in these things? And he said, something very valuable. So now she's really listening. Mm-hmm. And then she said, well, where'd you get them from? And he pointed towards the coast. Huh. So this lady automatically thinks abalone, because abalone are being poached like crazy on the coast.
Anybody who lives in Northern California knows that abalone poaching is a big deal.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly. So she's oh my gosh, right? So
concerned citizen. Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So she calls Warden Freeling and says, hey, I think we have an abalone poacher and this is what's going on.
Okay.
And so he goes to the post office, and since they were being sent to China, I'm sure you guys get to do this too. Once they go through customs, they can be x-rayed and you can see what's in the box.
Yep.
And so he's like, okay, show me the abalone. And they end up being these succulents. And he's like, what the heck is this? You know,
right.
It was the first time. Like, none of us really knew about it.
When was it? What year would this have been?
2017, December of 2017.
Okay.
And so he's like, okay, I've got some succulents here. Are they native, not native? So he gets the California Native Plant Society involved. And he says, what is this? And they said, oh, yeah, these are native Dudleyas.
Hmm.
And he finds out that, plant poaching's a thing. And we weren't aware of it. We had no laws that protected plants, you know? And so he's like, okay, well, good to know. Hmm. But the guy had already left. Okay. So there was nothing he could do at that point. So case gets not forgotten, but, you know, nothing happens.
Plants,
and then,
the plants left the country?
No, so I'm sorry. So he decides to intercept the plants and he gives them to the California Native Plant Society. I believe they put some of them back in the ground. They tried to. And the other ones they kept, I think they were doing for educational purposes or something like that. But I know some of them went back into the ground, the ones that could.
Do you remember why, if there were no laws protecting plants in California, What authority did he use to seize the plants? Do you remember?
So he didn't. So he did. It was vandalism.
Vandalism.
Yeah. So vandalism is what he used.
Okay.
But he didn't know.
That's creative.
So we might have been kind of a gray area, to be honest. Yeah. Now that I think about it, you know, because it's like, he had these Dudleys. We knew that they were native, and based on it, turns out you can actually look at some of these plants and tell that they came from the wild.
I see.
Because unlike a nursery plant that looks perfect, right? No bugs, perfect fertilizer, perfect control of light. In the wild, that's not the case.
Right.
You know, so you end up getting bug bites and different coloration. They grow towards the sun. So you have these things that key you in that they're wild.
Mm-hmm.
So they had an idea that, they got these from the wild and they shouldn't be doing it. And I'm guessing that's what, I'm not sure it wasn't my case, but could point.
he could articulate something, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
Exactly. And that's all you need to do.
So, and he did say we got them from, you know, and he pointed to the coast, but.
Okay.
So anyways, the case gets forgotten. And then I think it was like a couple months later, they get another tip. There's some guys that are out, or a guy that's out on the bluff and he has a backpack and it's, you know, a known abalone poaching area. So again, Warden Freeling's thinking abalone poaching. Abalone poaching. Abalone. I'm sorry.
But another tip from the public, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a suspicious guy out here with a backpack poking around.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Which would be consistent with an abalone poacher.
For sure.
Yeah.
So he gets in his truck and he drives down there as quick as he can. He sneaks up on him and the guy has a backpack and he ends up searching the backpack and finds these darn plants, Dudleus. So now he knows where they're getting them, you know.
Interesting.
And it turns out he was able to look at video from the post office. He was able to match it to this guy.
Same guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
So then he's like, okay.
Even better.
You know, and so he ends up taking the guy back to his vehicle, and his vehicle's filled with a bunch of Dudleus.
Bad guy's vehicle.
But he's still going, okay, there's no fish and game law.
Right.
I don't know what to necessarily do, but we definitely have, you know, vandalism. And there is a penal code law that protects plants, that mentions plants, but it doesn't really have any bite to it.
Yeah, okay.
So it's kind of like, what do I do?
It's just like a very blanket. I think I've looked at that one. It's like PC 182 maybe or something like that, where it's like just a general unlawful remove plants from public land.
Yeah.
I think, something like
and
that.
And the fine's
and
not a big
fine,
deal. Yeah. It's not very scary.
Yeah.
You know, it's not something that's going to deter someone,
yeah.
You know? So we try to throw in, are there any felonies, no vandalism or what?
right.
And so he said, okay, I'm going to try and do this. We'll throw in vandalism. And I'm pretty certain this was the guy. He actually had him go out there and put some of the plants away because he's like, well,
him.
What do I do?
Yeah.
You know, whether it was successful or not, those plants, who knows? But it was like, okay, this is a new thing. I don't know what's going on.
Right,
but
right.
So Warren Freeling decides, you know, I got to share this with people.
Good
this
for
is
him.
The second time. So I'm going to send out this email to people, some key people, and just give them a heads up. This is going on. And one of the people was me. So I got the email and I see Dudleus.
Right.
And it turns out that when I was in college, I worked for, I worked at the Arboretum under Stephen McCabe. He is the Dudleus expert. In fact, I think he's probably the expert, if not in the world, you know, he knows a lot about Dudleus. And so I remember him telling me about there's certain species of Dudleus or certain, species of them that are endangered and are only in certain areas and all this stuff. And I remember that and I got to work with them. So when I saw Dudleus, it was like, oh, hey,
this could be important.
This is happening. And this is not good. And I remember him mentioning that they were being poached in certain areas. So that's how I actually learned about it for the first time. So I let Warden Freeling know, hey, if you get anything else in the other cases, we're happy to help. We're on it. We're interested in this.
So this piqued SOU's interest.
Exactly. Exactly.
Probably also because you smelled commercialization here.
Oh,
right?
For sure. Yeah. There's no way they're taking that many and just
for personal
decorating
use.
Their home. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. So then another tip comes in.
Wow.
And actually, I shouldn't say another tip. It turned out that between the two cases, they were able to get the media involved.
Okay.
And so then people learned for the first time, okay, people are going and taking plants, you know, not abalone out on our bluffs. This is interesting.
Okay.
Which is really good because it's now educated the people and they're looking for it. And so a tip comes in and I see the tip. We have this system called CalTip, so anyone can look and see. And I see and I'm like, okay, we're gonna look into this. And so we end up looking into it. And we end up making our first Dudleus case. And then we ended up making a few more before this
ones,
big
kinda
one.
Off.
Yeah, they're a lot smaller than the one that we're going to eventually talk about. But but it involved like 800 plants. And these were people coming from another country, from South Korea. And so we busted them. And we got pretty good results. We got $10,000 fines for them.
Okay.
And they got kicked out of the country and all the plants seized. So again, it turned into a media sensation, which was really good. Made a couple other cases. But we started to realize there's a problem.
Mm.
And that was the laws were deficient. There wasn't enough laws. We're being creative, but sooner or later, someone's going to challenge us. Vandalism.
Right, yeah.
I was using conspiracy. I mean, I was trying to really get creative on this because I wanted it to have some bite, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no fish and game code. So why are you guys even out there, you know? So that was one of the challenges. The other challenge is we realized that people were coming from other countries.
Yeah.
And they were doing this. So it's like, well, a random person comes to our country, they rent a rental vehicle, they're only here for a short time, in the middle of the night they do this thing, and it's like a needle in a haystack.
Yeah.
How do you catch these guys?
But it also is very organized, right? It smells.
Oh, very, like, very,
like
very organized.
Your detective sense is like, this is something serious, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So eventually, this would lead, you know, the media of sensation would get out, and we would get the case, I'd say it's the case of my career. It really is. We would get very interesting tip that was not like any other we've
kind
ever
blew
gotten.
It out of the water.
Yeah.
What was the tip?
So the tip was from someone from South Korea. which I've never got. I'm a state game warden. I'm sure you guys get them all the time. So it's not a big deal.
Yeah,
to you.
We get the foreign nationals that do call the tip line.
Yeah. But yeah. So for me, no way. Okay. You know, and so it was like, what the heck?
Right.
But they had learned about this. Apparently it had reached different countries, you know? And so they knew that this person was coming to our country and they were poaching Dudley-a.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm all, okay, cool. So I was able to get enough information. It was basic stuff, but enough information to find out who this person was. And so I'm like, okay. So I contacted Customs and Border Patrol and I said, hey, could you let me know if this guy comes to our country? We want to get on him. He's committing these crimes.
Right. And you know, this is actually a perfect place where the states can take advantage of the abilities of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, because U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service can tap into those U.S. Customs and Border Protection and Homeland Security databases that give us heads up when people are coming in out of the country.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And eventually I would actually use one of your agents.
Okay.
And she would facilitate all of that in letting us know, because, you know, we're not used to this kind of international crime. I mean, we'll work with other states sometimes when you have cross states.
But it's hard for you when it leaves the California border, your jurisdiction ends.
Exactly.
So it's hard, hard to do it. Yeah.
So, and working with customs and knowing how to do it, it's kind of like, what the heck? So.
Okay. So, so anyway, you get this cool grand tip.
Yeah. That I'm like, oh, all right.
Korean guy's coming in.
Exactly.
To poach plants.
So, I get a call from customs. He's coming in.
Okay.
Yeah, he's coming in. He knew the date. It was like in the next day or two.
Yeah, they usually get a heads up, maybe sometimes a day or a few hours sometimes.
Exactly.
Before, but they know
so it was
coming.
A little bit of notice. And our team is staged in Northern California. But we had enough, well, I shouldn't say we. I had enough time to get down here and set up a surveillance. So I'm like, okay, I'm ready. So I wasn't able to capture him at the airport because we didn't have a full team. But he wrote down.
You came in down to L.A. To LAX.
Yeah, so I came down to LAX. And it was August of 2018. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to try to find this guy. But again, a needle in a haystack.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, oh my God, there's so many people. And I totally miss the guy. I'm trying to look. I know what he looks like. Customs and Border Patrol gave me a picture of him. But there's like thousands of people exiting. You know, it's the international part. Yep. And I'm like, okay, this is not going to happen. But Customs was able to provide me with information on where at least he claimed he was staying.
Okay.
So it was a hotel. And I went to that hotel. And sure enough, I ended up running into him. So
nice.
I'm like, right on. So he ends up meeting with the gal. They stay the night. And the next morning, I was joined by a couple guys that were in SoCal so they can help me with the surveillance. And they only have one vehicle, and it was the gal's vehicle. He was sharing that. So when she left, I thought, well, you know, he's stuck there. Let's follow and see what she's doing.
Okay.
So we end up following her to a international shipping company, Max Cargo Inc. in Compton.
Yep.
And I'm like, well, this is kind of interesting.
That's
they
interesting.
Said there were some interesting ways of how he was getting them out of the country. Well, this looks pretty darn interesting.
You're right.
Well, it turned out she worked there. So we ended up leaving her.
Perfect.
Exactly. And I went back to the hotel because I'm like, I don't know, maybe he's going to Uber it up or something, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I ended up sitting at the hotel for a while and, you know, he doesn't come out. And next thing I know, the housekeeper goes in and he's not there. And I'm like, oh, crud. So he had left when we had followed her somehow. And he never came back. So we stayed there for a couple days, never came back. And I ended up losing him. So I learned that he was there for a couple weeks. But still, we had our first step. We know the guy.
Good information.
Yeah, we have this international company.
You know he's connected to this export company.
Exactly. So, and you know.
Don't give anything away as far as law enforcement techniques, but this kind of surveillance is very labor intensive.
Oh, very.
Yeah. I mean, explain to people how many state officers did you have working on this surveillance? And this would probably sounds like a light one.
Yeah. So, so that particular one was probably only three. But we would, when we start getting the meat potatoes of this case, we'll have like seven or eight.
Yeah,
exactly. Cause you're going around the clock.
Yeah.
And it's like, you got to rotate people or people are going to get tired, you know?
And that kind of surveillance is, it's hours and hours of boredom sitting in a parking lot watching. And you can't like be on your phone because if you're looking down, you'll miss what's happening.
Exactly.
And then, but the funny thing, I don't know if you agree with this or not, but my experience was I'd sit in a parking lot for hours and hours and hours with many other agents on a team spread out around and you're watching and you're bored out of your mind. And then all of a sudden the bad guy comes out and you completely forgot. You've been sitting there for 6 hours and now it's all fun.
Yeah.
It's all worth it.
Exactly.
Because now the bad guy's doing something.
Oh, totally. Oh, totally. Or when you're doing around the clock surveillance, you know, what we would do is say, okay, everybody go to sleep in your car.
Right. But one person's
up. Awake, but have your radio cranked up. Mm-hmm. And that person gets on the radio and says, oh, he's coming out. And you have to jump up. Your hair is going crazy. And you're jumping in the front. Exactly. And you're like, oh my God. Okay. It's just. Yep.
And you got to have the
hearts beating.
You got to have the Coca-Colas, the caffeine. Whatever caffeine you'd have, it has to be going.
Exactly.
24 hours.
Exactly. It's crazy.
It's fun, but also crazy. All right. Anyway, I mean to interrupt.
Oh, no,
but,
no worries. That's
but
good.
But I think listeners will be fascinated to know this goes on. You know, there are teams of law enforcement officers working a case, and they might be in your neighborhood, and you'll never see them. You'll never know they're there.
We're in regular vehicles.
Yeah. Might look like work vehicles.
I wear flip-flops to school. I meant to school to work.
Yeah.
I felt like I was in school. Shorts. Yeah.
Ponytail. Yeah, they'll never see them. They'll never know they were there, and you might have half a dozen to a dozen law enforcement officers in your right where you are watching somebody.
Exactly.
Kind of cool.
Exactly. But like everything, the surveillances don't always work out.
They don't always
perfectly.
Work out. Sometimes you lose them because you don't want to get burned, right?
Exactly.
You got to make sure they don't see you. So sometimes that means you lose them.
Exactly. In this case, we didn't have enough people and I lost them. But I said, okay, you know, it sounded like from what the tip said, this guy was coming here a lot. So I had a feeling he'd
be back.
And he did spend 2 weeks in our country. So he likely did some poaching.
Yep.
But I got another tip. It was in October, beginning of October. 2018, and it was from customs guy again, and he's like, he's coming back.
Same guy's coming back.
And I'm like, cool. He's all, but he's leaving that very day to Mexico. And I'm like, okay.
So he's coming into LA and then immediately going to Mexico.
Yeah.
Okay.
But then
what's this guy's name, by the way?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Hey, that would help. Byung-Soo Kim.
Korean national.
Yes, okay. Exactly.
Have you named your case yet at this point? Operation Korean Exports.
Yeah, because they were coming from Korea and they were exporting it supposedly, you know,
like
not
it.
Very creative.
No, I like
but
it. It's good. That's good. Operation Korean Exports. Okay, so Byung-Soo Kim comes in, then he's going to Mexico. Why?
And he has a partner. It turned out. So we were able to identify him. It was Young and Back.
Okay.
And so I'm like, okay, they're going to Mexico. But that I knew. I remember talking to the expert that I worked for, the Dudley expert. And Mexico has a species of Dudley pacophytum, that's endangered.
Ah.
So I'm like, oh my God, he's going and doing with that. And there's a lot of poaching involving Dudley pacophytum. And the same things, they're very, very slow growers.
Right.
And I remember, I think he had a few there and he would be like, don't even touch the leaves because there's a powder and you can ruin them now and all this stuff, you know? So it's a very sensitive species. And sure enough, he's going to Mexico. So I'm like, okay,
it fits.
You know, it fits, the profile. Right. So I found out when he was coming back. He said he is going to return to the U.S. And I said, okay. So then I decided, okay, the day before he came back, I drove all the way down to L.A. And this time we had a team with him. Because we're like, okay, it didn't work with just a few of us.
Yeah.
We need our surveillance team.
You got
team.
The full SOU team.
Yeah,
now.
So it's a full SOU team. And we're ready for him. And we're sitting up at LAX for his return and his partner. And sure enough, we had a couple guys on foot at the customs where you actually cross
come
over.
Through,
and they're known to alert us, you know, to do the little wing thing or whatever. And we're watching for them. And we see them right when they cross in, which is good. So
now,
our guys.
At this point, have you linked up with U.S. Fish and Wildlife?
We have.
Yeah.
So they were the ones who actually.
Get you into that part of the airport really easily.
You're the one who got us into the airport. It also, you at this point, I said customs. I think you guys were the ones who were facilitating that relationship with them.
Yeah, that'd be
so, fair. Yeah. But you guys definitely got us in the airport because there was no way. We were behind the scenes there with the customs guys.
Right. And this is what I love about when the Fish and Wildlife Service works with the state agencies the way it's supposed to happen.
Yeah.
Right? Like we are supposed to be your FBI.
Yeah.
And if you have something going on outside the jurisdiction of your jurisdiction beyond the state borders, U.S. Fish and Wildlife can step in and be a huge help to you.
Totally.
And it's not about stealing cases.
No.
It's about us bringing our resources to you so you guys can make a case.
In fact, I'm not even sure. Doing surveillance without being in that position where we see them cross customs.
Yeah, from the minute they come in.
Because it's just a fan, right? They all come out. And how do you find it? Again, it's a needle in a haystack. But in this case, the agent, the Fish and Wildlife Service agent, was able to take us literally right there.
Yep.
And they had it set up that when they got alert, they're crossing over now. We were able to follow from that point on. So we also had some folks out on the street in plain vehicles. And so we watched them arrived. They got on a bus to a rental car facility, and we followed them there, and they ended up renting a car, and that began the whole thing, you know?
And now you're in a, what they call a rolling surveillance.
Exactly.
Where you're in cars and you're following these people. Where'd they go from the airport?
So from the airport, they ended up, initially they went to the hotel, they stayed the night.
In LA.
Then, yeah. And in the morning, they went to a nursery, which made me a little concerned. I'm like, oh gosh. So maybe they're getting these things
from
a nursery.
They're going to go buy at a nursery.
So all we know is they went to this nursery called Secret Garden Nursery in Vista. Uh-huh. So this is kind of like San Diego area, Vista, California is where it's at. So we're like, okay, we weren't able to set up surveillance on the nursery at this time, but we knew that that's where they went. And we're like, okay, well, let's see. Still, we might have a case. So anyways, we end up following them to Costco. They leave the nursery, go to a Costco, and we look in the car. We're able to peer in through the windows.
Nice.
And we notice there's backpacks in there and there's boxes. And we're like, okay, you know, if you're going to a nursery, you're not going to say, hey, thank you for my plant, and throw it in a backpack.
Right.
So now we're hopeful.
They're going collecting.
So sure enough, we keep following them. They end up going to the airport, picking up a third person, and that was Bongju Kim.
Okay.
And then they start heading north.
Okay.
When I mean north, I mean 850 miles north.
Holy smokes.
I mean, so they drove all the way to Crescent City.
Instead of flying into San Francisco, they fly into LA and then they go north.
Well, because the connection to the nursery. It will be connected later on. There's a lot more to it.
Okay.
At first, I thought, are they buying plants there?
Right, right.
But it will turn out that they were using that as their hub.
Got it.
So,
okay.
Yeah. So they get in their car and off we go. And we had no idea where we're going, right? We're just following, and we do this long trek all the way up to Crescent City. And it was a long one. And then they find a hotel and they get to sleep. And we have to stay. We're 24 Amazing. Hours right now. People are rotating. You're sleeping in your car and, you know.
There's so many logistics that go into that. So there's stationary surveillance, and that can be tricky in a rural or an urban setting. And that's where you're sitting in the car and you're bored out of your mind and you're watching somebody. Then there's what's called rolling surveillance, where you're actually in vehicles following somebody. And you can't change lanes when they change lanes. You can't make a right turn when they make a right turn. It's a very units that do a lot of rolling surveillance and know how to do it. They're very well trained. They're very well practiced. They work as a team. They communicate very well. And they're almost invisible. Right? Bad guys do not know they're there.
But then
you switch from, you're doing this rolling surveillance in an urban environment like LA, which has to be pretty tight.
Yeah.
It's easy to lose people in traffic. Then you get out on the highway. Now that's a whole different kind of rolling surveillance where it's pretty loose.
Yeah.
But now you're at higher speeds and you got to stop for gas and you got to time it.
Yep.
It's complicated.
Oh, yeah. And you're having to fill up your gas.
Yeah. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
You got to get gas, right?
You're rotating people.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm breaking off for gas or I'm.
Somebody's got to use the bathroom.
Yeah.
Got to eat.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's crazy. So this is awesome.
Yeah.
So you guys do
it's
an 800 mile rolling surveillance.
Yeah. And we're already on them. Like I said, we came the day before and then we start setting them up when they're sleeping in the hotel back in Vista. We were up all night as well. So
doing
we're
the one, all, one person awake.
Exactly. Yeah. Sleeping in your car the best you can. So we end up following him to Crescent City.
You're exhausted.
So now you're in a rural environment, which is really tricky for surveillance.
Super hard.
There's not all these cover cars that you could get in between them. It's you, right?
It's you,
So yeah, it's a little tricky. So they wake up in the morning and we're like, okay, let's see what happens. And sure enough, they drive to the coast.
Okay.
They drive to DeMartin State Beach, it was called. And it's also known as like North Coast Redwood State Park, I think is the other name. And they park there and sure enough, they get out with their backpacks.
Nice.
So they're like, okay, game on.
It's happening.
Right? But that's also true.
Now everything's worth it, right?
Exactly.
You totally
Thank
forgot.
God they're not buying them. Well, it would have been nice if they were buying them from nursery, but clearly they're not. They're here to poach, you know.
But now you've totally forgotten about all the hassle you've been through for the last 8 hours.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay.
And they have these empty backpacks on.
Nice.
Who hikes with empty backpacks, right?
I mean,
okay, they're going to put something in it, we're thinking.
I love it. What'd you see? What'd you see them do?
Okay, so what we see is we see them start hiking out. And they go a mile away from the beach and they're going over rocks and we would later find ropes where they would use ropes to climb over these big boulders. I mean, they were pretty hardcore. Yeah. So they went really far out to an area we called Split Rock. It was this huge cathedral-like rock and it was split in the middle. So we just named it Split Rock. I don't know if they actually called it that way. But doing surveillance on that was a little tricky.
Super tricky.
Yeah, so we had a really far point that we can watch them from, but it's not like we could just walk along the beach behind them, because no one's going out that far,
right.
And they would see you. Even though there were areas where there were boulders, you could hide behind them. The problem is you'd have to go in these open areas.
Yeah. So and God forbid you're seen hiding.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, way and out there. That's not going to... No,
you can't be like ducking behind boulders, because they're definitely going to know you.
Exactly.
Cops.
And even if they said, okay, someone hiking,
yeah,
that's only going to fly once, right?
Yeah,
same person hiking the next day. Nah, it's not going to add up. So we're like, okay, but we need to see what they're doing. So
yeah.
How do we do this?
Yeah.
So we found that there was this vista, this little turnout that we can hike, and it was pretty steep, hike down through all the shrub, and we could get down there, and we had cover, and we can actually watch them from that.
Nice. Perfect.
So myself and Warden Bagdasarian, we did that part. And we have people, when you're doing surveillance, you have people that are doing this part of it. We were the follow team on foot. We have someone who's watching from afar with their spotting scope. You have other people that are set up on the car when it returns.
Yep.
Other people ready for the follow. I mean, there's
all
these different positions. So we decide to hike down this bluff. And I learned that North Coast has stinging nettle.
Oh.
So I learned that
the hard way.
So both Warden Bagdasarian and I, when we were trying to be really cool and stealth and hike down this steep bluff, end up falling down into this steep, I don't know, it's kind of a hole. And both of us, it takes us both out. And I'm like, what is this kind of tingling in? It's nettle, it's stinging nettle. I'm like, oh, great. So, but anyways, we end up extracting ourselves from this very stinging nettle stuff that I didn't even know we had. And we end up getting a great point. And we end up watching them, and they're climbing up on the bluffs. And sure enough, they're pulling out these big old clumps of Dudleya, tossing them down to each other.
Wow.
And it was all three of them were doing it. And interesting, they would actually take off all the soil from them, and they were sorting them and putting them in backpacks and stuff like that. And then we continued to watch, and they did this for hours. And we noticed that there would be one person at a time acting as kind of the lookout.
Okay.
You'd see that they would walk up to a boulder, look around, make sure no one was coming, and do some stuff like that.
Interesting.
So we watched all this, and they filled up their backpacks with these Dudleyas, and they were, like I said, climbing up these cliffs and stuff, stepping all over the other vegetation. And
doing a lot of damage.
Yeah, exactly. All this erosion and things. So they get their backpacks filled, and then they start hiking back. And the thing about hiking back, in this particular case, we decide, well, we are going to try to risk it, because you're more likely... Oh, on the first one, I don't think we did follow them in. But on a future one, we would actually follow them in, but hide behind rocks and be a little more stealthy. But on this one, we stayed where we were, and we sort of did, but not too much, because we were kind of... You're being conservative. You know, when you start getting more familiar with the surveillance, you start taking bigger risks.
Exactly.
But this was the first time. So in this case, we're just kind of staying kind of far if we could. And so when they start hiking in, we notice they're using radios, and they kind of split up. And one person, they end up dropping the backpack and leaving it. And when they get close to the beach where their car's parked,
right.
He goes in without the backpack. The backpack's left behind.
Okay.
So they're smart.
Yeah.
He's looking around, you know. Yeah. And then they're using hand signals, and he ends up flagging the other guys in. And they end up going back to the car with the backpacks.
You know what?
So
nothing says intent better than that.
I love it. Don't you? Radios right? Communicate.
You know you're breaking the law when you're doing stuff like that. You can't claim, I didn't know it was illegal.
Exactly. Those are the best suspects,
too.
Because it's like, no mercy, right? They know they're breaking their law.
Exactly.
I have no
sympathy for those guys.
So we end up following them. They go to a Safeway, and we end up videoing them sorting out the Dudleyas and putting them in those boxes we mentioned.
In the Safeway parking lot?
In the Safeway parking lot, they're actually sorting them out.
Classic.
And then they go back. But this time, they end up where that vista I talked to you about. They end up parking there. Well, not parking there. Pulling into that vista area, and two guys jump out of the car, and the other guy drives away. So now they're doing drop-offs, and he parks at the beach, and they hike down the same area. I'm like, oh, crud, that we had hiked down. They went down that way.
Where you're hiding in the nettles.
Exactly. And they ended up having backpacks. And I don't know if somebody else or if it was us that kind of got them hinked up, got a little scared, and they end up leaving empty-handed.
Huh. They stashed what they had.
Yeah. So we saw them harvesting, and yet they left empty-handed. And we walked down there, and we found piles of Dudleya. So I think maybe they got a little nervous.
Sometimes, they get spooked about stuff that has nothing to do with the surveillance team.
And you're right.
They might have seen the same car drive through that was just a tourist and it happened to drive through twice. And
exactly.
They get paranoid. Yeah.
Exactly. In fact, you know what was funny is during this case, when we were getting ready to hike down the Vista one of the days, it was a Vista, so it's beautiful view. Yeah. So tourists park there every now and then, you know, just stop for the little quick shoot, you know.
Can't control what the public does.
Exactly. And they sent off a drone.
Oh.
So I'm hearing bzzz, and I'm like, what's going on? And sure enough, we see this drone, and law enforcement doesn't like to be videoed, especially when you're undercover.
Yeah.
So that was kind of funny. But anyways, we end up watching them for a few days. And on the third day, I thought, okay, this is, you know, we're pretty tired by now. Yeah. Round the clock surveillance. This is getting old. So I end up getting a tracker warrant. We end up installing it on the vehicle. And one of the hardest things to do when you're the case agent is saying, we need to pull off for now and people need a little rest.
Yeah, that's hard. That's a hard call to make.
And I decided we're going to do it. We've got the tracker on. We had watched them for 3 days.
Yeah, you know what they're doing.
Doing it, yeah.
Documented everything you need to document.
We've got it all on video, beautiful video, showing them pulling these clumps and stuff. And so let's take a break. And what we're going to do is when they start heading back, see what the heck they're doing with these things.
Right.
And so
that was smart.
Yeah, so we end up doing that, and we all go home, and then...
You know what? I got to interrupt, because I realize some of our listeners might not know what a tracker is. They'll probably assume.
Oh, yeah.
But basically, a tracker is item you put on a car, and it gives you GPS coordinates of that vehicle, and you can kind of monitor it remotely.
Yeah, and it's real time.
It's real time, and it's real, and you do have to have a warrant to put it on somebody's vehicle.
Now you do.
We used to love to go slap trackers on people's cars. But yeah, you do have to have a warrant now, Supreme Court ruling. But the thing about GPS trackers is they'll tell you where a car's going, but they won't tell you what the people are doing.
Exactly.
So you got to have that eyes on to see what they do, where they go.
Exactly.
But in your case, you'd already documented what they were doing, so now you just need to kind of make sure you know where they are.
Yeah, and we were able, they ended up staying there for, I think it was about a week.
Yeah.
And they were going to the beach.
So they're taking a lot of plants.
Exactly.
Wow.
So we're like, okay, this is going on. We want to see what's going to happen with these guys.
Now, what do they do with them once they got them?
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. So what you can do also with a tracker is ping, like you could say, okay, if they leave this area, ping me,
right.
You know, but I'm actively on my computer watching what these guys are doing. And sure enough, I see them start heading south and I'm like, you guys, I think it's probably about time. And I think they're leaving.
They're
so we end up getting in our cars and start heading north and we end up intersecting them in Redding, which is probably, I'm not going to guess 4 hours or so. It's a ways from them, but we end up intercepting. Actually, I intercept them there. And then I meet up with the rest of the team in Sacramento and we follow them all the way down to Vista.
Wow.
And they got a late start. So we didn't get back to Vista till 3 a.m.
Oh
so that was
God.
Very hardcore. One of those where you're going, wake up, you know, and you have the air conditioning on, it's winter, you know, you're trying to stay awake.
Yeah.
So that was a pretty hardcore follow,
but we
made it. And of course they get to go to sleep.
Yep.
And the hotel and we have to stay up. But then the next morning, we had an idea that they might be going to that nursery, you know?
Right.
So we had done some pre-surveillance on that nursery to find out, is there any lookout points and so forth. And so we were able to find a spot. It was kind of a weird thing through a neighborhood and stuff where we can actually watch them when they went up to this nursery. And they went into this nursery and parked in front of one of the greenhouses and start offloading all the plants.
Huh.
Okay. And they start going into this nursery. So I'm like, this is really interesting.
Yeah.
So what are they doing here? So so we watched that, get that all on video. And then sure enough, I'm like, okay, we've got a lot. In fact, it's time to start writing some paperwork, some search warrants, arrest warrants, and those sort of things. But they get in the vehicle and they start heading north again. I'm like, ah, crud.
Without the plants now. The plants,
exactly, the plants get left there.
And this is that, what's the name of their nursery?
Secret Garden.
In Vista,
California.
Okay, so they leave the plants there.
Yes.
I,
and when I say the nursery, I should say this is a huge nursery.
Okay.
And like they have all these greenhouses.
Right?
Yeah, and so we would later find out that they rented a greenhouse. So the nursery had no idea. They weren't part of this. They just rented this greenhouse and this guy was doing, you know, business.
Okay.
So I don't think that they had any idea of what was going on.
What was your impression at this point? Well, at this point, you probably didn't know, but ultimately, what do you think? My first thought when you said they were taking things to a nursery was they were going to try to launder it and make it look like it was you know, propagated.
You
here
get a gold inertia. Star.
Oh, is that what they were doing?
Because that's what's going to happen.
Oh,
you stole the secret.
I'm sorry. Well, when you were talking it, I was saying, well, oh, maybe exactly. They're just using it as a storage facility, no. But they were going to launder it.
Oh, they would do some really secret stuff. So at this point, we're like, okay, we got to split because I got to start writing some serious paperwork, yeah, right? Yeah. All the warrants and, you know, the not so fun stuff.
Right.
And so we send the team off, and this time they go to Sonoma Coast, which isn't as far, maybe 600 miles. It isn't as far north. It's more central coast. You know, just above San Francisco. And they, sure enough, they do more harvesting.
More
and
poaching.
Watch. Oh, yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah, a lot more poaching. And they watch them do that and while I'm simultaneously getting this paperwork done.
Uh-huh.
And I remember I talked to some folks and they said that they don't do Ramey warrants, which are arrest warrants for individuals. Someone had told me that.
And yeah, like, really? So explain a Ramey warrant. We never use those in the federal system, but
so we rarely use them too. And I was told LA didn't do it, but it turns out it's wrong. But it's where you actually want them to not just get put in jail and get arrested. You actually want there to be an arrest warrant, so they have to actually go to jail and actually go through the whole system of meeting with a judge and that sort of thing. It's more of a conservative way of doing things. And I went that route because these guys are from South Korea, and at any time they can just leave the country, right?
So
if they get kicked.
This is makes it a little different than what we would call in the business a PC arrest, right?
Yeah,
so
that's different.
So a PC
the
arrest
judge is signing off and saying you have
probable cause.
I have probable cause. I've met it, and we have. I mean, I'm showing him pictures of the deadly and stuff, and he's like, "Oh, overwhelming."
Yeah.
And in fact, I thought I had beyond a reasonable doubt at that point. You know.
So for our listeners, the difference here is, sometimes an officer, whether they're federal or state, will be out in the field. They will encounter somebody committing a crime. The officer will make the determination, I have probable cause to arrest this person.
Yep.
They'll make the arrest on the spot. That's called a PC arrest.
Yep, exactly.
And this Ramey warrant is, and feds do this too, will go to a judge in advance.
And they order it.
Yeah, we usually do it through what's called a complaint in the federal system. And we'll say, here's the facts we got, judge. We'll swear it in front of the judge, and then they'll say, I agree, you have probable cause, authorize you to go arrest them.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's a little bit, like you said, you kind of go, the minute the handcuffs go on, it's a little bit, it's a beefier kind of warrant.
Yeah, it's
you can
safe,
hold
but judges signed off on it. This is bigger time. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So I wanted to make sure everything was good because of this whole international connection, you know,
that's
and I
smart.
Wanted to be able to.
That was really smart. Because these guys will flee, as we might find out.
The other thing was, is, you know, a tricky thing as a state warden, and maybe with you guys too, given the fact that they're going to Crescent City, they're going to Sonoma, they're going to San Diego. These are three different counties.
Yeah, your jurisdictions.
They flew into LA. So we have all these different places. And as a state game warden, I get to pick where I want to prosecute.
Same for the feds. Same.
Okay. And I usually want to pick where the crime happened.
Right.
And although the crime's being taken back to San Diego and eventually they would ship it, the people that were wronged were the northern people, and they take it a lot more serious. You're here in my area, my backyard.
My
and still, they take it personally. I wanted,
makes sense,
and I needed to get them from San Diego to Crescent City, which would eventually be a big deal. So anyways, they end up following back. Same thing happens. They end up taking the Dudleyas to the nursery, and we watch the offload.
Wow.
So we're like, okay. And then something curious happens. Byung-Soo Kim drives to a county office, an inspector, where they do inspection, plan inspection. I'm going, what? You know? And he meets up with a county inspector. So, and he makes some sort of arrangement. We didn't know what was going on, but then he leaves and we go in there, ID ourselves and say, what the heck's going on here? We find out he set up an appointment for that day for them to inspect his plants.
Perfect.
And I'm like, inspect the plants he poached? What? Can I see the paperwork? Sure enough, it says that they got them all in San Diego,
propagated
is where they got all the plants. And
from the nursery.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
So, and so now he's going to try and make this a legitimate business by having this inspector, who doesn't know, he didn't watch all the surveillance,
right,
sign off on it, and now it'd be good to go as soon as he does that, right? So we're like, okay, so we let them in on it. Hey, you know.
Okay, now, I got to interrupt you again, because the reason he's doing this is because this is awesome. He's a smart guy.
Oh, yeah.
When you export plants legally from the U.S., you have to have what's called a site phytosanitary permit.
Certificate. Yep.
And that's just to ensure that there's no pests or diseases on the plants before they're moving international commerce.
Exactly.
So, yeah, so he's setting it up for, he's
I didn't even know this.
Beautiful launderer.
I'm scratching
well,
my head.
Another great reason to have the feds involved, right?
Because exactly.
we deal with this crap all the time.
I'm like a Fido what?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I can't even pronounce it. But
yeah.
Some
so,
sort of.
So now
so
you
he's,
have.
This is smart.
You talk about interagency, though. But
yeah.
So now you have the feds, the state, and now you have a county inspector
county,
that's
right.
involved. And, you know, and we're always, you know, who you're going to let know what's going on. But we decide, hey, you know, we're going to tell them what's going on. And we get that, we convince them to let one of our officers go in with them.
Nice.
As be the, one of the
to
inspectors.
To do the inspection on the
so
plants.
We can video and hear what's going on.
Says, brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely.
Brilliant.
They were very cooperative.
Brilliant.
So we go in there and they inspect the plants. And they had taken, apparently part of the thing of getting a phytosanitary certificate, you can't have any soil. That's why they were getting all
the soil off.
Yeah. So you can't have any soil on it. They have to be clean plants because I guess that's where some of the pests are.
Yeah, right.
So they have to have really clean plants. And so the inspector inspects them all. And on the phytosanitary certificate, he had claimed there was like, I don't know, exact number, it was around 1,400 plants.
Wow.
Well, we would later learn after counting, it was actually 3,715.
Jeez.
Okay, so he was only claiming about 60% of what he was taking. And that's important because later we'd look at other phytosanitary certificates that he filled out. So anyway, so he fills out this certificate. We get it all on video. And his lies got him from San Diego and,
nice.
You know, so forth. So the county officer blesses him because that was what he would normally do.
And during this inspection, Byung-Soo Kim is there.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
exactly.
Nice. So he can answer questions from your guy who's posing as
an
agriculture
inspector.
So our
guy's there talking
That's
to him,
beautiful.
Seeing what's going on.
Nice.
Oh, it's fantastic.
That's
it was
beautiful.
Beautiful.
I love it.
Again, at this point, we're at beyond a reasonable doubt.
Oh,
I'm like,
totally.
Come on, bring it on.
The case is made.
Yeah.
Man.
So this is beautiful.
This is
so,
great.
So I also would talk to the county inspector and find out that he has been getting phytosanitary certificates since 2013.
Oh.
And I'm like, oh, okay. And eventually I'd get a, I don't know if I got a warrant, just a cooperation. I don't want to get too far ahead, but I would inspect those and get some really interesting information. Yeah.
So Byung-Soo Kim's been doing this
for years.
Shtick since 2013, and we're at 2019 now, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
2018. So anyways, we finished the whole county thing and they load them all into boxes. There was 37 boxes to get them all in the rental vehicle and two rental vehicles. They ended up doing another rental vehicle and they end up driving to Max Cargo Inc. On the first inspection that ended up being a failure, they end up taking these plants
this
there.
This is the place that on your very first surveillance when you had the light team, the woman he met with.
Yes.
Went to this Max Cargo in Compton.
Perfect. Exactly. So
Wait,
I'm like,
full circle. Oh,
okay,
full
here
circle.
We are.
Yeah.
And that must be his connection, you know?
That's
and sure enough, it would
be. That's his export connection.
Exactly.
Nice.
So we end up, okay, now the time is, when are we going to jam him? When are we going to do it? But we want him to get, I had written what they call an anticipatory warrant.
Yep. Okay.
So it means that if these things are met, because I had an idea it was going to get shipped, because I knew that they had gone to this international shipping company.
That's
so
smart.
I said, if they go there and drop off these plants, I want to be able to search the plants and so forth. So
trigger,
I set up this
trigger the warrant when that happens.
Yeah. So I had a ton of plants. I had a search warrant for that, arrest warrants for all the three suspects, search warrant for the car, search warrant for the nursery. So all this was done ahead of time. And
nice.
I was like, okay, we're ready. But now when do we do it, you know? So I said, okay, let's wait till he gets to the actual, you know, we need him to deliver the plant so we can activate that part. So sure enough, he backs up, offloads all the plants in a beautiful little stack, and we're videoing all this. And then we had uniforms officers on standby because they do a lot of help with the transportation and things like that.
Yep.
And we all move in all at once.
So did you let him drop off and leave and then pull him over?
No.
You just hit him right when he
right
dropped
there.
Him off.
Because we wanted him there when, because it's wonderful to open up the box and go, this is what I'm talking about, right?
Right in front of him, yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of like.
Oh, that is such a rewarding, the takedown is always so rewarding,
it's
man.
Beautiful.
When you, especially when you see those uniforms coming in and you're like, this dude is done.
Yeah, exactly. And I think they did too. The eyes, oh boy.
Because we
like the dramatic. The officers coming in. We don't just bring in. It was several officers.
Oh,
all coming in. And then we walk in with our, you know, plain clothes. And we were there with a Fish and Wildlife Service agent. So at that time, Agent Laura Chi had joined us as well. So she was there. She was going to help with the interviews and also with the search warrants. So, of course, we opened the boxes and we already know what's going to be in them. And they're labeled live plants, you know. And so we get that all on video.
Because this is the beauty of his plan. He's smuggling in plain sight.
Yeah.
That's the beauty of his plan.
I have to admit, out of all of them, this was our smartest one. Okay. I mean, he was well organized.
Yeah, he's well organized.
We found out he had been doing this since 2013.
Yeah. I mean, this guy, he is a hardcore trafficker.
Oh, yeah. Oh, completely.
There's no question about it.
Yeah. Like I said, we would add up those plants and there would be 3,715 just in this load.
Yeah.
So we would also go and inspect, we got a search warrant on his cell phone too. I got that. I would find photographs of him in other countries, I believe poaching plants, including Mexico.
Okay.
This is funny. I have to mention this. I would also find a news article of one of my prior Dudley cases.
Oh, no kidding.
Where I had busted them and it says that they were convicted of felonies, $10,000 fines. So he went there knowing all this information.
Oh my gosh.
So I'm like, okay. I mean, that was beautiful being able to show that, you know.
I mean, that gives you, you've got, that shows knowledge.
Yeah.
Knowledge of the law. Yeah. Then you've got this, you know, when you did your surveillance, he's leaving the backpack till he gets to the parking lot. Then he's motioning people to bring it in after he checks to me. So there's intent, right? So you know he's got knowledge of the law and he's intentionally violating it. Boy, that's
and total disregard of the law, right? Because
total
he knows.
Disregard.
And the thing
that's
is,
a tight case.
$10,000 fine. Each suspect got that. We had seized $10,200 from him. We got to keep that.
Yeah.
They got kicked out of the country forever, you know? So all these things happened to the prior suspects.
Yeah.
He was still willing to come.
Still willing.
That means that's just the price of doing business.
Yeah, that shows you the value, right?
It was still worth the risk to come here, which tells me they're getting a pretty darn good reward, right?
Which brings me to, everybody's going to want to know, this 3,000 plants you stopped at that moment, what do you think just those are worth overseas?
So I actually knew. It was over $600,000. I'm going to go, why the heck did I know? Yeah. Well,
how do you know?
It was wonderful. One of my prior cases, the lady was wonderful enough to actually make a price list. And it was based on the number of heads. So Dudley, when they start to mature, they'll branch out into these different heads. So they form this beautiful rosette, but they're these different stalks. I'm going to call them heads. But there's these stalks, and then there's a beautiful rosette head on each of them. So if it was one head, it would be worth $100. But I also, and I didn't just use her price list, but I had her price list and she was selling them. This lady was, and she had all this, we found them on the internet, but we also found a Korean website.
Mm-hmm.
And they were also selling Dudley farinosa, the Dudley that we were finding on our coast. And so I was able to use those numbers too, to actually come up with an exact number. And I don't remember, it was 602 something. I don't remember exactly, but $602,000 this load.
That's incredible.
Based on heads. So unfortunately, someone had to count.
How many heads?
How many had one head? How many had two heads? Because each was a different price. If there was a five head, it was worth upward of $2,500.
Jeez.
So I'm like, okay, we need to sort these. We need to create this chart and come up with this price because I want to be able to tell the judge.
You're already thinking ahead to sentencing. Yeah, that's good.
What the heck is that?
Good for you.
We did those search warrants on that. We did the search warrant at the nursery, found the backpacks, found the radios.
Nice.
But they had stashed a lot of stuff there and it made us believe that they were, you know, this was a base
they're
of operation.
Back.
They're coming back.
They're coming
back. Well, luckily they weren't going to because we're going to nail them.
Not this time, but the plan was they're coming back.
When I got the Ramio warrant, I looked at the judge. I said, yeah, you know, I think they're, you know, they're, oh, we had found out that they did have a flight booked. That your agent or Fish and Wildlife Service agent had determined that they were going to fly out that night.
Wow, you just caught him. You just caught him.
So that was another reason why. And I had told the judge, you know, they have this flight when he signed the Ramey warrant, you know, to leave tonight. He's all, they're not leaving tonight. And he laughed. And I'm like, yeah, they're not.
Nice.
So we end up interviewing them at that facility. And they were very cooperative. I don't think the management actually knew. I mean, by now they're legitimate.
Yeah.
Phytosanitary certificates. And
the export company is just like a stooge, really. They don't
exactly.
know.
So they don't know. They were very cooperative. They let us even use their conference room where we interviewed.
So he's under arrest. You've Mirandized him and he agrees to talk.
Yeah. Okay. And he confesses to everything.
Really?
They all do.
Okay.
But what we learned.
Who'd you hook up at that moment at the Compton place? Byung-Soo Kim and anybody else?
So we all three.
Oh, you got
all
three?
So they were all three there. Byung-soo Kim, Young-in Bak, and Bong Joon Kim.
Nice.
Yeah, all three were in the same place. Transporting. So it was really easy.
Really easy.
We were just having, and we had the uniform. So we'd be like, okay, you guys wait here while we go interview suspect one. It was myself and Agent Chi. Mm-hmm. And Agent Chi with Fish and Wildlife Service, she actually said, you know, I'll take the lead on the interview. She said, sure, why not? You know, and I'd sit there and throw in any questions that I needed. And she got him to confess everything. And we found out from Young-in Bak, he said, you know, I'm working. I'm an employee for Byung-soo Kim.
Okay.
So we found that out. But him and Byung-soo Kim really knew each other for a while. Bong Joon Kim also admitted, hey, I didn't even really know these two. Hmm. I met him on a previous flight. I was looking for a job. I had mentioned this. He took my name. All of a sudden, I get a call when I'm in South Korea from this guy saying, you want to come to America? I'll pay you, I think it was, I'll pay for everything when you're there, your flight, your hotel, everything. You won't have any expenses. And I'll give you $1,700 is what they told him for this amount of time that he was there. So, but they eventually admit to knowing it was illegal.
Nice.
Which is nice. Those statements are nice.
Yep.
Using radios and so forth. So it was beautiful. We're like,
beautiful.
This is wonderful. So we end up booking them.
You book them in L.A., but your charges are going to be out of
Crescent City. So that in itself was a challenge.
Yeah.
How the heck am I going to get three guys from point A to point B? Because nobody else is going to do it for you. They've got their own.
Did you transport them up there?
So I arranged, believe it or not, I arranged it for, I think it's LA officers. They were going to Stockton. I said, okay, can you take them to the Stockton jail? Yes. Okay, Stockton, can they stay overnight? Yes. Okay, then they were going to Sacramento's at a hub for prisoner exchange hub.
Okay.
So I said, can you take them to Sacramento? Then they were driven to Sacramento because we couldn't do it because we're not really trained to transport
long distance.
Yeah, because you got to feed, house.
We just feeding,
that was a little complicated. We didn't know what the rules of the games were, so they stayed the night. I had to, so I'm talking to LA, go to Stockton, arrange for them to keep them overnight. Then I get somebody to take them to Sacramento.
Mm-hmm.
Then I convince Eureka. Hey, they said we're going to go pick up somebody anyways. We'll pick up your guys and we'll take them to Eureka.
Like Eureka Sheriff's Office or Fish and Wildlife.
No, it was California either the sheriff or the police department. I don't remember which one, but it's not us.
I'll tell you what, man. The best people are getting linked up with for prisoner transport or sheriff's department.
It probably was them.
That's what they do.
Exactly.
Or U.S. Marshals, one or the other.
So they end up taking them to Eureka, which is like about an hour from Crescent City. But I still need to get them to Crescent City, but Crescent City then agreed. You get them to Eureka some miraculous way, you know, we'll go down to Eureka and pick them up. And that's what happened. So that in itself was an adventure.
Sure.
But it happened.
Nice.
And then, so we end up starting with the court process, which, as you know, it can take a long time.
And so I don't want to get in too much detail on that, but we'll skip ahead to the juicy part that happened. So basically what happens after somebody's arrested, of course, they have an opportunity to appear in front of a judge.
Yep.
They're going to enter a plea and they'll figure out whether they hire private counsel or they get public defenders, whatever, depending on their resources. But then the court process starts. And one of the first things that a judge is going to consider, of course, every defendant's going to ask for bail or to be let out pending future. And to me, I think it's insane that any judge would ever let a foreign national out.
Exactly.
But it happens in both the federal and state system that foreign nationals do get bail. And in this case, these guys asked for bail. And did they all three get bail?
They all. And you know what? I even begged. I was there in court and the district attorney said, do you want to talk and try and convince him? I said, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I said, these guys have been doing it. They know. And, and one thing that I hadn't mentioned.
And so money's huge. So the flight risk is.
It even gets huger.
Yeah.
So remember I said that they had these phytosanitary certificates. So I went back and I looked and they had been coming since 2013. Since 2013, between 2013 and 2018, Byung-soo Kim claimed to have taken over 120,000 plants.
What?
On paper.
Whoa.
So I knew he had taken, remember, more we're just talking 3,715 on this one, but he has taken over this time period over 120,000.
But didn't he, on his permits, wasn't he claiming a lot less than 3,000?
He was only claiming about 60%. So that's probably, 170? I mean, this is a lot.
So if you assume he did that every time, but what's on paper is how many?
120,000. Over 120, it was like 122 something, 122,000.
So if we assume that's 60-70% of the reality?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
So I'm telling the judges, this guy's been doing this forever. Please don't let him out on bail. But sure enough.
Yeah.
Yep,
and you know what happens a lot with the judges in the federal system as well? They'll have the foreign national, and they'll say, we'll let you out on bail, but, you know, maybe you have to pay a bail. And you have to give up your passport. That is a bunch of crap, okay? Because I don't know why judges don't know this, but if you're an American and you're traveling overseas and you lose your passport or somebody steals it, you just go to the local American embassy. They'll give you a new one.
Yeah.
And in Los Angeles or San Francisco, big cities, South Korea has a consulate.
Yep.
And it takes nothing for somebody to go get a replacement passport. So turning in your passport as a condition of release means nothing.
Well, and we had seized their passports.
Oh, you did? But who cares, right? They don't care.
And I would learn that. I thought, well, I got the passport.
But, and the judge probably was like, well, we have the passports and you're going to pay the bail. But when you're talking about $600,000 in one shipment, bail was how much? Do you remember?
I don't.
Not much,
they did have
probably.
A bail bond guy, but yeah.
They're willing to skip that bail. They don't care.
They were willing and they did.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, these guys had a lot of money. So they get out on bail on the state charges, and this is where it gets a little weird. Do you mind if I tell the federal side of it?
Yes, because I don't really know it.
So because these guys were, once they turned the plants over to the exporter, they had placed it into international commerce.
Okay.
So that part was done. And what happened was that triggers what's called the Lacey Act, which is a federal law. And if you export wildlife or plants, if you move them in interstate commerce or try to export them, plants taken in violation of state law, you are now committing a federal offense under the Lacey Act. And that triggers that whole thing of it's now leaving California's jurisdiction. It's hard for California to enforce.
Yeah.
So it becomes a federal offense so the feds can get involved.
Okay.
Anyway, so when they turned those plants over to that Compton export or whatever, what's it called? Mega export?
Max Cargo.
Max Cargo. Yeah. Once they turn it over to that Max Cargo in Compton, they've committed it to international commerce.
Okay.
So they've committed that Lacey Act violation. Okay. And so what the feds did, and I don't really understand, I think if my recollection is correct, I was at the time, although I spent most of my career in Los Angeles, at the time I was based in Africa on a 5-year assignment to be an agent over in Africa. I was in South Africa. And
I'm jealous.
I know. It was pretty hard work, let me tell you. It was hard work, actually, but it was pretty cool. Anyway, so what I recollect from talking to the supervisor here in LA is that we started to get concerned, the feds started to get concerned that Byung-Soo Kim and his crew were going to jump bail. And so we went ahead and filed our charges.
Yeah.
And that was in, I believe, December of 2018.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Toward the end of the year.
Yeah.
So we were getting worried they were going to run. And so we filed.
Yep.
And then we got an arrest warrant for them as well, too. So they ended up getting arrested by the feds as well. And they got bail from the federal.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Holy cow. Twice.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. I think that's what happened. I will double check that and make sure that that's updated on our website. But I remember you guys were going to arrest them.
And I remember. Yeah.
I know there is an arrest warrant in the court records for these guys. And there was a complaint issued. I don't know if we actually hooked them up or they fled before.
Yeah.
But now we're going to jump to these guys flee, right? What they did is exactly what you would do.
Of course.
They went to the South Korean consulate and they said their passports were stolen in Santa Monica.
Yep.
And they got new passports and then they immediately went to Mexico.
So I don't know if I told you this because they would end up going, I think you guys told us Mexico, then China, and then finally back home,
back
right?
to South Korea.
So I would call Customs and Border Patrol and say, hey, can you stop them? I'm naive. Like you said, you guys know how to deal with this. I don't. Can you stop them there and tell them we want them back? I'm so naive,
stop
right?
them in like China or South Korea?
In
or
South Korea. And they, we talked to them. We said hello, but they don't want to come back. And that was that. You know, I was so naive because I'm like, well, it all worked out very pretty when you guys did it, you know. So, that wasn't very successful. So here they are. Actually, two of them fled.
The other one you guys ended up arresting, Bong Joo Kim, I remember you guys did get
maybe
and end
that,
up prosecuting.
Maybe that's what it was, is yeah. that I think we had the arrest warrant for Byung Soo Kim and the other one, one yeah. of the other ones, and they fled before
yeah,
we could
get
them.
Yeah, they got into Mexico, but we got the other guy.
Yep. Okay, that's what it was. We never actually took... Okay, so we never took Byung Soo Kim and the other one into custody.
Exactly.
They fled before we could get them.
Yeah.
That's what happened. But we had charged them.
Exactly.
That's what it was.
Exactly.
So they didn't get federal bail. They got state bail.
Yeah.
Fled on that. And then we did manage to grab that other guy before he got out. Yeah. That's what happened.
So now I'm crying.
I'll bet. Yeah, there's
our
nothing worse.
Crying,
it's like, oh my gosh, now what, right?
Yeah, the hours, the man, it was just, it was dreadful.
Yeah.
It was dreadful.
Once Young Soo Kim fled along with, what was the other
Young guy? And Back.
Young and Back also fled. So what happened is when they fled, we had charged them federally. So now they have warrants out for their arrest from the state of California because they've jumped bail.
Yep.
And we have a federal warrant for their arrest. So they know this. They know they've jumped bail. They're not coming back to the U.S. So what happened is I happened to be in South Africa at the time, and Agent Aaron Dean, who was the supervisor here in Southern California, she remembered, or I think when they arrested, so the young...
Bong Joo Kim.
When they arrested Bong Joo Kim here in L.A., they found in his personal belongings a receipt from a nursery, a plant nursery in Cape Town. That's the only document that they saw in his records related to any other place in the world. And she knew I was there, so she called me one day, and I'm at the embassy, happened to be at the office, and she explains this case to me. It's the first time I'd heard about it. And I was like, wow, that's weird. And she says, do you know anything about this nursery? And I said, no, I never heard about it, but I can ask around. And I was like, what's the deal with this case? So she explains it. And I said, Aaron, I said, these succulent plants, they really only grow three places in the world. California coast, Mexico, as you mentioned, and the Western Cape of South Africa. And I was like, these guys know they have warrants in the U.S. They're coming here. They're going to come to South Africa. And I was like, this is awesome. I said, send me everything you got. If you don't mind, send me everything you got. So she sent me everything on this case, the state charges, the reports from Agent Chi, I think some of your reports. I got everything. And what I did was within about 24 hours, 48 hours maybe, I put together a briefing packet, and I went and I briefed the South African police and the Department of Environmental Affairs in South Africa. And I basically gave them a in-person briefing.
Yeah.
This is what happened in the U.S. This is the situation. And I said, I think he's coming here. And I said, I would be on alert, right? And that's it. And honestly, I left, and I honestly didn't know. I kind of was like, I walked out in the parking lot, and I'm like, I wonder if they'll do anything. You know, I was like,
yeah,
I said, I don't know.
Out of your hands at that point.
I give them the information. It's their business whether they do anything with it. I knew them. You know, I knew they were good officers, and South African police are pretty good about plant stuff. And I was like, well, maybe. Anyway, 10 days later, I get a phone call at the embassy.
This is so crazy.
This is crazy. 10 days later, I get a phone call from the South African police, and they're like, yeah, we just hooked up your guy. And I'm like, what? And he goes, yeah, we arrested Byung Soo Kim in Cape Town, and you're not going to believe this. We went back to his hotel room after we arrested him. He had $1 million worth of succulent plants recently poached from the Cape. So he went immediately from the States. This is October of 2019. So he basically went, you know, he fled in the late fall of 2018, and by October 2019, he is back at it.
He's not even
didn't miss
deterred
a beat.
At all.
Didn't
yeah,
miss
that's
a
great.
Beat. Just changed his
luck.
Yeah,
give the presentation and bam, you're magical.
I know. It's kind of like, wow, this is the way it's actually supposed to work.
That's awesome.
So he gets arrested in Cape Town with $1 million worth of these plants in his possession. And the same thing starts to unfold. He wants bail. The nice ending to this story with you today is that we got Kim back.
Yeah.
We got Kim back to California.
Yep. Woohoo!
Woohoo! He was actually extradited back to the United States from South Africa.
Yeah.
And he faced the music here in the U.S.
Both from you and from us.
Both from the feds and the state of California. Yeah. So, and the reason I want to give that spoiler in this episode is I want to give you an opportunity to have the pleasure of telling us the penalties he got here in California this poor guy went through the ringer.
Not only the penalties. Remember I said this was the case of my career?
This is the case of your career, and I wanted
magical
to get to that.
Things would happen.
Yes.
Yes.
Big changes because of this case, right?
So, exactly.
Yeah.
So you guys ended up arresting him,
yep.
and they went through you guys, and
yep.
you guys got some great stuff. And then
we extradited him back to the U.S. Yeah.
So we end up flying them from LA with our own jet.
Yeah. Okay. So now we got to spoil a little more.
Yeah,
so the feds get him back to the States.
Yes.
And because he's extradited, now he's got federal charges
yep.
in state. The fed goes first.
Yep.
We charged him. We tried him here in the States. He pled guilty and he was sentenced to 24 months in prison federally here in Southern California. And because he was exporting out of here. The federal judge, all of a sudden, so we thought, okay, he's going to get time served for the time he spent in jail after he arrived in the States after being extradited. But the federal judge decided, no, I'm going to give him credit for time served in South Africa, which, in my opinion, wrong legal decision because
different crime.
He had to do his time in South Africa for his South African crimes. Then he does, anyway. So unexpectedly, he has spent... Well, he spent a good amount of time in federal custody here. I think it was, eight months or so.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden, he's released, right?
And
we're
like,
no, he's not. We got to turn him over to the state of California. Okay, so that's a funny story in and of itself because the poor guy, while he was in custody in the U.S., he got crosswise with a gang member in his prison, and he got beat up bad. And he had his jaw wired shut.
Yeah.
I felt bad for him. I mean, it's not funny because it's horrible what happened to him, but he did get beaten up in prison in federal custody and he had his jaw wired shut while he was recovering.
I'll tell you, his personality changed it was kind of cocky.
Yep.
I'm invincible.
Yeah.
To a lot more humble when I saw him the next time. I'll tell you that.
He had spent some time in some very hardcore prisons.
Yeah.
South Africa was not easy for him.
Yeah.
And the federal system, because he got beat up, was not good. But so anyway, all of a sudden you have to make arrangements to take custody of him. How did that happen? What happened
there? And I'm panicking. I think I don't know if it was
I think I called you and said, oh my God, he's going to be released. You got to get on
and
this.
And it was like, what was it? A day? It wasn't it
was
much
short.
Time. And
yeah,
I'm like,
short.
Oh my God, what do we do? What do we do? And so we're going over everything, right? I can't do the whole transfer him to these four different places. That's not going to fly it that quickly.
Right.
So we do have jets. Mm. I don't know what kind of jets they are, but they're pretty fancy that are for our director and higher folks. So we decide, let's convince them to let us use this nice jet. And
right.
I wasn't sure if it was going to fly, but sure enough, they said, yeah, we're
nice.
Going to do it. And so they send our private jet, our private Department of Fish and Wildlife nice jet.
So California Department of Fish and Wildlife plane comes down.
Yeah, and we needed officers to escort them. So they jump on board, and we fly as Tushy back to Crescent City. And it was like, of course, that was a sensation. Woohoo! Little Crescent City, because this is a really small town. We're getting this guy extradited. He's international, you know.
Right.
So it was a big deal. It was
Very
a big
cool.
deal for us, you
Very
know.
Cool.
So that happened, and he ended up going there. Of course, the judge said no bail.
No
this
bail
time.
This time.
And jails, judges, they might be nice the first time, but if you lie to a judge, they're pretty ticked
off. If you
off.
Flee, you're not getting bail a second time.
No. And he wasn't very happy about it. So anyways, they end up playing out. They end up getting a $10,000 fine.
Okay.
So we never got Youngin back.
Right.
He ended up going to South Korea.
He is still a fugitive. For his arrest. Yep.
But the main guy who was the mastermind, he ended up getting a $10,000 fine. And then they gave him restitution charges of, I think it was like $142,000,
nice.
If I remember.
Okay.
They yanked all he had nursery licenses and all these licenses. They yanked all that and said, you can't have any more licenses.
Good.
And they sentenced him to 2 years in jail time.
In state prison. So he's done his his time
and
in federal.
Now you're going back to jail.
Now you go back to
jail. And they're saying you're actually going back to jail,
you
know?
Be
they
state
gave
prison.
Him a teeny bit of time served, but I remember this number, it's 545 days he was still going to serve in jail, even with time served.
Nice.
So I'm like, cool. He's still got some more time. He might be thinking he's done, but he's not, you know? And it really was a victory. And it hit the media like a storm, right?
This case made The Guardian. And, the headline was, something about, the, you know, plant poaching king or something you guys brought down, which is pretty cool.
Oh, it was a big deal, mm-hmm. you know, because he was, like I said, over 100, you know, upper of 200,000 plants near, you know.
Yeah, but you're talking about a $600,000 shipment in 2019, and he'd been doing it since 2013. This guy was millions and millions of dollars. Yeah.
And that's how he can afford to have international tickets,
oh, yeah.
hotels, renting vehicles, renting the nursery. That all costs money.
A lot of money.
Hiring employees.
Hiring people, yeah.
It's a drop in the bucket, right?
Yeah, totally.
That's why when he saw, you know, so that was good. All the jail time really hits home to me, because that's the deterrent that you're actually going to serve this time. And he did.
And the media was great because it got worldwide attention, and anybody who was thinking about poaching plants, who thought, I'll just get a slap on the wrist. This is a true deterrent, right?
Because you can. We're going to go to another country and get your tushy if you do this. We're not messing around anymore. So that had some serious bite.
That's awesome. And
they even made a film out of it called Plant Heist.
Plant Heist. See. Okay.
Yeah, it tells the whole story, both of this case and how it all started in the other cases. It's pretty neat. And most of those cases are the Special Operations Unit team along with Warden Freeling. And it's really cool.
Nice. Plant Heist. So, okay, make sure our listeners and viewers go see Plant Heist.
Look at it. It's online. I think it's probably YouTube. I don't know if you throw out for YouTube.
So you mentioned that this was the most important case of your career. Why?
Yes. Because I had mentioned earlier, we didn't have any laws, right?
Yeah, right.
And I had, when these prior cases happened, I had thrown it out there. We were talking about it. Hey, we need laws. We need laws that are fish and game code that have some teeth to them. I can't be always pulling vandalism out, conspiracy. I need something else.
Right.
And shockingly, they were like, okay, yeah, let's look at this. But then when this case happened, they're like, yeah, we have a problem. We need to do something about it. This is big.
I mean, you mean state legislature finally.
Exactly.
Woke up. Yeah.
And when you say government, I think a lot of us think snail slow.
Not things. Always.
Yeah. Not in this case. Mm. It was rocket fast.
Nice.
They were all on it. And I don't know. I wish I could throw out who worked on it, their names, because it was pretty amazing, and it got pushed through. And now they created this new law. Before I even left, they had it out there. It was Fish and Game Code 2024. And it said your first violation is $5,000 to $50,000. No more of this $10,000. That's so just your first violation.
Judge has a lot of discretion there depending on how serious it is, right?
You come back and you do it. Mm. So say you're a citizen in the U.S., so you're not kicked out of the country and you're able to do it again. It's now $50,000 to $500,000.
Nice.
So that was a huge deal. That was a big deal for us, a new law getting created. But the other thing, and I only learned about this recently, I went on to read that someone wanted to know what our mission statement was. And I was shocked because it used to be, had a bunch of stuff, but it said to protect fish and wildlife and the habitats that they live in.
Right.
Well, I read our mission statement. It now says fish, wildlife, and plant resources.
Nice.
And I'm like, oh, this is, that was fantastic. So they're taking this serious now.
Right.
Got new laws. We have the new mission statement that tells other wardens, you know, because at first they're like, we do bears. We do deer.
Bears,
plants,
cougars, deer.
I don't think so. But now everybody's like, we have laws. This is real. This is a lot of money. Yeah. We're on it.
Right. No, and a better appreciation for just the amount of damage that can one guy can facilitate, right?
Over 100,000 plants, 120,000 plants. Can you imagine the buff and the damage and all the plants that they, and this is one person, like you said.
Yeah.
Now multiply that by the other people that are doing it. That's some major damage that's happening. Yeah. It's so sad.
We're going to wrap up here pretty quick, but weren't some of these plants returned to the wild, if I remember correctly?
So, Michael Van Haddam.
That doesn't happen very often.
Yeah. What's interesting is, so because of the soil thing, it was kind of cool. If we knew where the plants came, so like the Crescent City plants, we knew they all came from DeMartin Beach, that area.
You'd seen it.
Because of that, they were able to return them to that area.
Nice.
So Michael Van Haddam was able to take the plants that they knew there and actually return them to it. Some of the other plants from prior cases, if they put them in soil, they couldn't return to the wild, but they were taken to places for educational purposes. But they got a lot of plants that they put there. And there was tons of volunteers that went out there.
Nice.
California Native Plant Society,
you know, parks, just a ton of people that were willing to go out there and put these thousands of plants back on these bluffs.
Where they belong.
You know, exactly.
That's amazing.
And my understanding is Michael Van Hattem is still, he's our environmental scientist, was going out there. He's like a supervisor and actually seeing what the success rate is. Because just because you put them back
doesn't
necessarily mean that they're still there. You know, if a windstorm comes or rain, they could get washed down. So he's looking into that. But at least there was this great effort.
Yeah.
To put them out.
You give them a chance.
Yeah, exactly. Right? And I'm sure some took.
And these plants can live a long time, outlive us.
100 years?
Yeah.
I was shocked. He held one up, this really beautiful plant, and he's all, this is about a 100-year-old plant. But it's like devastating. That's, people are stealing these, you know, horrible.
Well, you know what? Good for you, man. That's awesome. Congratulations to you
the team.
Yeah, the whole SOU team. That's
the feds, this county. It was just wonderful.
Amazing. It's an amazing case. It was an amazing example of how the feds work with the state.
Yeah.
The great work that the California Department of Fish and Wildlife does on a, you know, less budget than most law enforcement agencies in this state operate under.
Exactly. And how new laws can come about.
Yeah, and got new laws, got the plants back, got the bad guy. And this is just an awesome case.
Win-win. Yeah.
I mean, cool. Kudos to you.
So
great.
Dudleas are now famous.
They are super famous. And I thank you so much for coming on the show to tell this story.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
It's been great. It's a story that I just absolutely love. I could talk about all day.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear part two.
Well, I think you'll enjoy hearing from Ann Hiraman, the prosecutor in South Africa. She, kind of funny how her first reaction to me when I called her, but now she is all about this case, let me tell you. So it's pretty cool. All right. Thank you, Savannah. Everybody, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a great episode. I appreciate Savannah Morgan being here to talk to us about her case. We'll see you next time. Nature Secret Service is written and produced by me, Ed Newcomer, and is co-produced by the DHTV team here at California State University, Dominguez Hills. Follow us on social media and connect with us online at naturesecretservice.com.